I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, a deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Let's talk about the details of this case. So first of all, Jacqueline, she was just 2 years of age when she lost her life too. I have a two-year-old little girl. They're the most innocent, vulnerable, naive, beautiful, breathtaking creatures. This little girl was being raised in Marion County, Florida by her mum. Also, she had been involved with her mother's boyfriend, Travis Thompson. Now, even though there'll be many single mums out there, I was a single mum myself. I have two new children with a husband that I've been with for many years now. The reality is I did have a single parenthood experience for several years. And during that period of time, I had to be acutely aware that if you introduce any man to your child, and it will be the same with stepmothers as well, you have to be really careful because the injuries to children in step-parent families far exceed those in non-step-parent families. And that's not for 1 minute to suggest that there are step-parents out there who are being horrible to their kids that they've taken on. Quite the contrary, for the most part, they're wonderful. It's just that there is a higher proportion of abuse that takes place in those families. Why? Because predators see vulnerability and seek out that vulnerability. So if you happen to be a single parent, you are a potential ground of vulnerability and you're looking for somebody potentially to step into that role because you want the best for your kids. And that means that if you happen to be a horrific predator, you'll see that as an opportunity and you'll exploit that opportunity. And I believe that Travis Thompson does that. Now, bear in mind, Jacqueline is 2 years of age. She's this gorgeous, sweet, energetic little girl. She's absolutely gorgeous. She's just starting to get curious about the world, as two-year-olds do. Apparently, she was always pointing out new things that she'd just learned, and she loved being the centre of attention. And children who tend to be securely attached are like that. They love people looking at them as long as a primary caregiver is by their side. And to all intents and purposes, I genuinely get a feeling that whilst life would not be perfect for the mother in this case, she genuinely was invested in the care of her child. And so it speaks to the fact that Jacqueline clearly had a good relationship with her mummy. Also, she loved singing, and according to people who knew her, she had the most infectious smile. But all of this is going to change because of the introduction of this waste of space. This innocent little girl's life is going to be taken away from her by someone that she should have been able to trust, someone who should have cared for her, and someone that her mother genuinely did trust, Travis Thompson, a person that she'd introduced into her daughter's life. But on the morning of May the 2nd, 2022, in Marion County, Jacqueline's mother comes home to what could only be described as her absolute worst nightmare. Every single parent out there, you know this feeling, you know this fear, you know that in your head you have this absolute real catastrophization that something awful could happen to your child. It's why we're so protective of our kids, and we have to work through it to allow them to take risks, but there is always that feeling in the pit of your stomach that what if? You do a lot to sink it down, to swallow it down, but it's there. Imagine when that comes to fruition and that worst nightmare comes true. That's exactly what happens to Jacqueline's mother. 25 minutes after she's left her trailer to go to work, she receives a call from Thompson and he says something is wrong with the toddler. You can imagine that sinking feeling in that phone call. Bear in mind, she had left her two-year-old child in the care of relatively new partner, 25-year-old Travis Thompson, believing that he was safe. He was a space that she could rely on. But now she's got that call, she's rushing back to the trailer, she's thinking, oh my God, what's going on? But bear in mind, if I was to get a call off my partner saying my child's ill, there's a spectrum of illness, isn't there? There's a gradient. So if I'm being called back to the trailer, I would be thinking to myself that clearly my child isn't so desperately ill they might die. Because ultimately, you'd have asked them to immediately call an ambulance. They would have already called an ambulance. They'd be running around the trailer site screaming for help. All of these things would be normal. So as you're heading back to the trailer, you're probably thinking that something bad might be happening, but ultimately you're not thinking something fatal is going on. Now, once Jacqueline's mother returns home, she literally found her daughter lifeless. Also, she immediately notices a distended abdomen and she notices a shallow pulse. So she's not dead yet, but it's very clear that she is very, very poorly, if not so poorly that she's not going to make it. And that's what Jacqueline's mother is facing. By the way, I haven't got Jacqueline's mother's name. And the reason for that is they've not allowed it to be out in the media. I presume that that's to protect her. Now, at this point, her mother and Thompson get into a vehicle to go to a nearby hospital. And terrifyingly, on this journey, her mother notices that Jacqueline stopped breathing. At this point, she instructs Thompson to contact 911 immediately, and this leads to an ambulance meeting the pair at a nearby business area to transport Jacqueline for medical treatment. But I don't even want to start to pretend to understand the horror that must have been going through Jacqueline's mother's mind in that moment in time. She's gone to work, everything was okay, and now she's dealing with her child who stopped breathing after being left with a man she introduced to her child's life. And I always think in these moments in time, when you go into that situation, it doesn't matter what kind of relationship you've had with this partner. This partner might have been somebody that you've got on with, you might feel safe around them, but the minute your child is so badly injured and now not breathing, you are going to start thinking, how has this happened? And you're going to be looking in the direction of that partner and thinking to yourself, what did you do? What did you do? By either neglect or through action, what did you do? Now, at this point, Jacqueline is so seriously unwell, they rush her to Advent Health Waterman Hospital in the ambulance. Doctors and the emergency response team are there to meet them, and they do everything they can to keep her alive. But her injuries, genuinely, guys, which I'll go through afterwards, they are far too extensive. They are literally unsurvivable. At this point, even though the doctors are not fully aware of what's caused her death, they think it's going to be internal bleeding. And so she dies at the hospital hours after she arrived. Jacqueline's mother left for work that morning and then in the afternoon is dealing with the death of her child. Now, as I've said, when it comes down to Jacqueline's mother, she isn't named officially in any public sources. That's to protect her identity. What we do know is she had been in an on and off style relationship with Travis Thompson. He wasn't the father of either of her children. And I always think with on-off relationships are the high-low relationships. And I always think that when you have a high-low relationship, it's because of an undercurrent of toxicity. The very fact that they're constantly breaking up and making up, it says that they get on, but there are real cracks within the foundation of that connection, and it's problematic and it's rooted in that toxicity. So I would imagine there's quite a lot of conflict that goes on in that relationship, and with respect, you don't want children around a step-parent to be who is very conflictual in nature. It's not good for them. It creates a very disturbing level of poor attachment, and it's the worst place for a child to be. That's not me trying to be highly judgmental to the mother in this case. With respect, everyone makes their choices. No one goes into a relationship thinking, hey, I want this real monster to be in my child's life. Usually the monster is very good at disguising themselves for a period of time. But when those true colours start to shine through, it's your job to leave. And with respect to the mother in this case, I do think she was starting to ultimately notice that he was not a safe place to be with. Now, Thompson, he does not have, as we would expect, the most perfect history. So we don't know a lot about his upbringing. I would say it would be dysfunctional, though. He does allege that he had been abused during his childhood. Not that that would in any way, shape or form mitigate his actions. So what we know is when we study individuals who dealt with horrendous abuse in childhood, what we tend to see in qualitative research down the line psychologically is they become really compassionate, really caring, oversensitive people who are often so concerned about everybody else's needs that they put their own needs on the back burner, and that actually makes them more likely to meet predators. So they get exploited further because they're good, compassionate human beings. It works against them because of what's happened in their childhood, because they just never want to cause the same level of harm to somebody else. However, some people who are abused statistically will also fall into the camp of having a predisposition for being an abuser. So we don't mitigate by saying, oh, well, they're abused, that's why they've gone on to abuse. That doesn't make sense at all. Actually, it's the opposite. But what we can say is, yes, proportionally, some children who will be abused will grow into predators because they were designed that way genetically. That's my view on it. Everybody else is allowed their own view. Now, he does end up getting raised by an uncle, and that uncle was very good to him. So again, like I said, even though there's not a lot of public information about this guy, clearly the fact that he's raised by an uncle says there was some instability in his life. And it also does give some leverage to a belief that maybe there was abuse playing out in his world. But in 2019, he essentially has an issue with the authorities because he breaks a four-year-old child's arm. This is in 2019. So the guy's 21, 22 years of age. What on earth is happening that he's broken a four-year-old's arm? And also bear in mind, keep this in the back of your mind when I talk about this case, because there is a parallel, as far as I'm concerned, with this particular offence and the ones that we're going to look at today. So he claimed he'd accidentally sat on them. I mean, I don't know about you. I spend quite a lot of time with children. I've got two very small girls. And if I'm not every 3 days sitting on some random child I haven't seen, I don't know what I'm doing in a play centre. I mean, children of that age, you hardly notice them. It's easy to just find yourself sitting on them in a place or space where you should have been able to notice them. But no, it's completely normal. I mean, ask yourself, in your entire adulthood, when did you last sit on a child and not notice they were there and then break their arm? But of course, this is the BS level that we would expect of this kind of predator. Now, with respect, for some bizarre reason, that case ended without an arrest. And I suppose it's because it's quite challenging to absolutely prove that this person didn't make a mistake. And unless you've got some kind of CCTV or witness evidence, you are relying on the child either telling a different story or the perpetrator admitting it. So even though it ends without an arrest, a protective injunction is ordered. So it legally restricts someone from contacting or approaching the person seeking protection. It can last for months. It can last for years. It can even last indefinitely. And he later receives a misdemeanor because he violates that injunction because he ends up possessing firearms, because obviously he has to behave in a certain way, and possessing firearms means he isn't following that injunction, so he then gets arrested for that. So that shows us that there is a predisposition for violence as far as I'm concerned, and you'll understand why I'm saying that as I talk about the injuries on this child, but also the fact that he doesn't care about consequences. It would also suggest he has problems with impulse control, and if you can't follow some very clear instructions such as don't have a firearm, it does speak to a level of narcissism within your nature that you don't have to follow rules, you don't have to have that rigour within your world, and that always bodes badly in life. Now, at the time that he gets into a relationship with Jacqueline's mum, he's reportedly unemployed or at least sporadically employed, so he doesn't have any long-term employment at that moment in time. He's also living in the trailer. And I suppose for Jacqueline's mum, she wants to be in a relationship with somebody. She's looking for a life partner. She's also probably thinking that if she can trust this individual, it's going to be helpful for her because he's unemployed. And let's be honest, childcare is ridiculously expensive in the Western world. And if you genuinely think you have a position where somebody can come in and look after your kids and do it safely and be a good person around them, that will be incredibly appealing. But clearly, it can also bias your decisions because life is busy, money is short, stress is high, and even though you should do your due diligence on the person you're spending time with, the person you're introducing your children to, because of all those other pressures, you could often have a level of, shall we say, bias of positivity around them. You can not be concerned about their worst and you can instead concentrate on their best because it means that you're in a situation where you can provide childcare for your kids without paying out for that childcare. Like I said, I'm not suggesting that was absolutely the reasoning behind letting him have access to the children without her being present. I'm saying at a time when people struggle financially and when stress is high and when childcare is exponentially expensive, I understand why some people can sometimes not do their due diligence as they should. Now, on May the 3rd, this is the day after poor Jacqueline dies, doctors at Advent Health Waterman Hospital had obviously realised that her injuries were terrible. They hadn't actually seen any injuries like this on a two-year-old in their history. That's how serious it was. So they end up reporting their concerns to the Sheriff's Office and the Department of Children's and Family Services. Now, the MCSOs, that's Mason County Sheriff's Office, Major Crimes Unit, they then respond to the hospital because child death is very, very rare. And child death with a severely injured child, where there's no apparent explanation for those injuries, obviously raises concerns of the highest level. So they begin an investigation quickly into Jacqueline's death. So they head over to the trailer. This is clearly a crime scene as well, potentially. This is where Jacqueline's mother and Travis are spending time. And they want to speak to them to try and work out how such utterly horrific injuries could have been inflicted on this little girl. Now, first of all, they knock on the caravan door. No one answers the door initially. So the officers do that good old detective work. They go and speak to some of the neighbours in the meantime. And one of the neighbours reports that, yeah, she would often see Jacqueline and her sibling outside, but they'd be unsupervised. So whilst I do appreciate we live in a very risk-averse world these days where children are wrapped up in cotton wool and that's not good for them, we also have to be aware that when children are unsupervised at a very young age, we're talking two, that is neglectful. I am all for children being out in the big wide world. I think it's really important for them. But an older sibling looking after a two-year-old child when there is not very much of an age gap between them, which clearly there wouldn't have been, that speaks purely of neglect. That neighbour actually went on to say this, you know, when you just get that feeling that these people just aren't normal and something's off. So there is something in that neighbour's intuition and instinct that speaks to them. There's just something about those people that they don't feel is safe, I would say. There's just something not right about them. And they're obviously talking about not just Travis Thompson there, they're talking about Jacqueline's mother as well. And I suppose that on reflection, people will say, well, hindsight's amazing, isn't it? Because when somebody finds out that something awful has happened, they can pick out certain memories that can be levered against those individuals, because all of a sudden, those moments that stood out really speak of something nasty. But equally, if something bad hadn't have played out, they might have got a completely different response from that neighbour. So I do acknowledge that. But for me, I genuinely think there was just something about them that concerned the people around them. And obviously, when you're living on a trailer park, you're in close proximity to each other. You hear things, you see things. And one neighbour actually recalled hearing an argument, and they actually heard that that argument was about the fact that Thompson had hit one of the kids, which is just a boundary that no step-parent should ever breach. The reality is, as a step-parent, you need to have clear boundaries. And one of those is, it is the parent, biologically, who decides on the discipline. I'm a massive believer in that, because it causes such issues in relationships where step-parents decide that their rules and their rigor is more important than the parent who would usually discipline them. I think that is just a breach. And the fact that there's an argument going on clearly represents that the mother in this case also believed that that was a breach. Now, as I said, when they're knocking on that door initially, the couple aren't in, but then later on in the day, they come home. At this point, the investigators carry out a search of the trailer, they tape it off as a crime scene, as they should. And when they start doing that search, they do find some concerning items, a lot of drug paraphernalia. This is a trailer. If you are smoking weed or taking drugs, you are literally in situ with the children. It's not hard for them to see you doing it. It's not hard for them to inhale whatever you're inhaling because they're present. And it's just a really poor strategy as a parent, full stop, to invite your children to see the worst of your behaviour. And that's what they're clearly doing. So they find weed pipes, grinders, rolling paper. They also found a small plastic bag in his wallet containing what looked like drugs. Also, they found firearms, including a loaded pistol, when they've got two children in that environment. Also, an assault rifle next to the bed. So this speaks of something really diabolical. The fact that a step-parent and the biological parent is allowing any of this around their children is ludicrous as far as I'm concerned. And that's before we even think about accidents happening, like a child ingesting drugs that they find. This has happened. Children have died of fentanyl poisoning in the US because they found something, had a taste of it, and it's killed them. So to be in such close proximity with assault rifles, pistols, and drugs demonstrates an absolute lack of care and a high level of neglect. Now, when Thompson is watching this play out, he's doing the weirdest thing. He's trying to make casual small talk with the officer who stood with them outside. He actually asks, must take a toll on you, huh? I mean, again, who would say that as the bereaved party? Oh, I feel really sorry for you as an officer of the law. It must take its toll on you. You've just been in a scenario where you've watched a child basically almost take their last breaths and you're bothered about the impact on the officer. What does that speak of? When you think about psychopaths, and I'm not going to say this guy was actually defined as a psychopath during the court because I haven't got that information. I am just going to tell you from my perspective regarding antisocial personality disorder and an individual has psychopathic traits. They just don't know how to emotionally be like you or I. Imagine the emotional vocabulary. You and I are so nuanced. We have a million different feelings. It's what makes us incredible as human beings. Psychopaths don't have that. They only have the big hitters. Imagine being somebody who hasn't got a sense of smell. that means you can only taste acidic, bitter, sweet, etc. You don't have that nuance of flavour. That's what psychopaths are like. And so what they do a lot of the time is try to mimic or imagine what a typical human being emotionally would be like, and then they try to play that out. This is a perfect example. To actually say to a police officer, this must take a toll on you, you're trying to say, I am empathic. But that's not how empathic people act in scenarios where they are essentially the victim. Which, if you truly lost a child that you loved, you would be the one being traumatized. You would be the victim. So the fact that he's externalizing that, projecting it onto the officer, demonstrates he's not connecting with that very real feeling we would expect from anybody with any kind of relationship to this child, let alone one who's been playing at being a primary caregiver. Also, he goes on to try to build rapport with that officer, telling him a story about when he bought an officer food because he saw this officer sat at a table alone and he wanted to, quote, ease the tension he was feeling. Again, how bizarre. So you are feeling tense, you're feeling stressed, maybe you can see an officer of the law, maybe you know that really you're a naughty person and you don't like knowing that you're a naughty person, maybe you know what's going on in your mind and the darkness within it, and because of that, it leads to a level of stress and you think, oh, how do I counter this stress? I'll make myself look like a really super kind person. I'll go over to this officer who sat down and buy them some food in some weird way of saying, I'm grateful for you, man. And also, now you think I'm a good person. It's weird. I'm all for, you know, applauding those who serve and protect. But this particular action speaks of some ongoing process within Thompson himself. It's about easing his own guilt because he knows the kind of human being he is. That trying to build a friendly relationship with a stranger who doesn't care about you because they've got more to bother about as an officer of the law is strange. Now, detectives end up learning from Jacqueline's mother that she had left Jacqueline in the care of Thompson earlier that morning. She was going to work. So the investigators immediately now know that Thompson's the only one looking after her at the time when she receives her injuries. So he is the person in the line of fire. He's the last person to see her alive. So understandably, the questions are around him. They begin questioning Thompson, firstly, on his relationship with the girl's mother, and again, it's a little bit on the bizarre, because if you happen to be somebody without true empathy, without true understanding, without true compassion, because you kind of miss those cues, then when you're asked this kind of question, you're going to overplay it. So he basically says she's his person, his go-to, his best friend. He tells them that he loves her very deeply and that girlfriend would be an insult to what he really feels and has with her. Yeah, so she is his girlfriend. But did you know, if a guy refers to you, or a woman refers to you as the girlfriend, it's an insult because it doesn't demonstrate the true depth of your feeling. I mean, it's utterly crazy. It makes no sense whatsoever. But here we are. Here we are in a scenario where Thompson believes that the word girlfriend does not define the true mammoth feelings that he has for this woman. And it's almost a betrayal, almost an insult to actually use those kind of words and terminology because they have something so special, so pure. Again, it's overplaying and he has no idea whether the officer who's talking to him about this has a girlfriend, which would actually be insulting the officer. Then he goes on, unprompted, to tell the officer that he's a selfless person and everything he does is for his partner and her children. Doesn't work, but apart from that, apart from not contributing in any way, shape or form financially to the children, at the end of the day, he's completely selfless. He does everything and anything with children. Well, except for when they're outside of the trailer, supervising themselves with literally no one around. He's just a selfless person looking after the kids. Well, apart from when he's got a rifle and a pistol and drug paraphernalia all around the actual place that they live. Apart from that, he's a completely selfless person. He is just so selfless that he's a massive drug user. He's violent and also he has weapons. But apart from that, this guy is absolutely 100% peaches and cream great dad of the year. Does everything for his partner and her children. Again, massively overstating his importance and telling the officers things they do not need to know. Now, when they move on to ask him about what happened that particular day when Jacqueline loses her life, Thompson basically tells the investigators that whilst he's in the bathroom of his camper, he'd heard a loud thud in the room where Jacqueline was. Again, just think about your experience with children. How often does a two-year-old make a really loud thud? You know, you might hear a little bit of a bang when they fall over on the knees. If they're jumping around on a bed and they lose the grip, again, you could hear a bit of a bang, but a really loud thud, that's not contextual. Then he goes into that room. By the way, why isn't he in the room with the child who's apparently made a really loud thud? I mean, he's meant to be looking after a two-year-old. She's two. A two-year-old should not be left unattended. It's as simple as that. Particularly when we know the environment that they are in has got drugs around her. So then he goes into this room. He says he finds her limp when he picks her up and she was gurgling. She'd also urinated on herself. At this point, he thinks that she's got a pulse and she was apparently taking shallow breaths. And he says he immediately begins CPR and then began making calls to 911, but they didn't go through. Yeah, they would have. Sorry. I mean, I'm sure that many of you have had an experience where somebody's rang 911 or 999 in the UK by mistake. My children both did it when they were young boys very, very easily. I got called back by the police on at least three occasions. On the third occasion, I will be honest with you, they were not very nice to me. And it was because my kids somehow knew how to do that. It happened to my sister as well. And I feel a lot of you will relate to this. What I'm saying is they always go through. 911 in America has got an astonishingly large amount of people who work on those lines to ensure that everyone gets through. But then, in spite of the fact that he can't get through to 911, he manages miraculously to call Jacqueline's mother so he can get through to her. And she, understandably, is horrified, rushes back from work to figure out what's happened. And bear in mind, that demonstrates, again, somebody who is trying to scrabble to put together the pieces of the jigsaw that simply don't fit. Because one of the things that is absolutely astonishing is that if she was so unwell, which he's saying she was, to the degree where he'd called 911, done CPR, called her mother back to the trailer, instead of driving to the hospital, he waited over 30 minutes for Jacqueline's mother to arrive back. 30 minutes. We're meant to believe that she was so gravely unwell that he's doing CPR. But he waits 30 minutes for Jacqueline's mother to come back. That's why they ended up both going to the hospital. Now, investigators at this point ask him, is there any chance that she could have come into any contact or ingested any of the drugs inside the home? Because they were clearly there, which he firmly denies. Of course he does, because he's such a responsible, loving individual who can't even put his girlfriend in the category of girlfriend because he's just got such a deep feeling for the whole family. I mean, he's just a one guy. Also, he claims the reason there are guns next to the bed is because he was just about to clean them. So he's just about to clean them. How convenient. The fact that there were loaded weapons in the environment is irrelevant. I mean, I'm a responsible parent. I would have to be a totally irresponsible parent to actually have just left them on the side where a child of two would be tall enough to grab one and maybe even discharge the gun by accident. That would be really irresponsible. So clearly I was just cleaning them, you know, before I cleaned the trailer that was also unsanitary and in a mess. Isn't it interesting what he's interested apparently in cleaning? We all know this is BS, but this is a lie he's telling. Now, understandably, they say to him, listen, there were drugs, there were firearms there, and he's continually just rebutting this and saying, I've got no idea how, and I've got no idea why this beautiful child died, essentially. So he's just denying everything, saying, no, it couldn't be drugs, saying he's no idea what's happened. All he knows is there was a thud, and then he went in, and she was severely injured. And then all the other things that lead to her ending up in hospital are just excused by him wanting the mother of the child to come back and assess whether they needed any further help, even though, like I said, he'd noted he was doing CPR on her apparently and just couldn't get through in all of that time to 911. Now, when the investigators speak to Jacqueline's mother, they find out, despite bearing in mind the fact that Thompson's just told them how she's more than just a girlfriend. Yeah, she is more than just a girlfriend. She's an ex-girlfriend. They'd actually broken up a week before. 1 week before, this relationship had come to an end. She'd moved out of the trailer that they shared together and she had ended that relationship. But on the night of May the 2nd, she ended up staying over because apparently he needed help fixing his car. And then she said that at 7 a.m. the next morning, Thompson took her eldest child to the school bus stop. Then he'd returned back to the caravan to look after Jacqueline. She'd then set off for work at this point, which is, of course, not long before she receives a call from him to say that Jacqueline is hurt. So that's the time frame that we've got. Now, isn't it interesting that she has broken off the relationship between he and her? This is apparently the woman that he is saying it shouldn't even be categorised as a girlfriend because they're just so close, their relationship is so deep. But the woman he's with doesn't want to be with him. How angry is he feeling? How rageful is he feeling? What conversations have gone on the night before where he's coming to the conclusion that maybe this relationship is over, and how does he feel about that? And then here he is in the presence of this two-year-old vulnerable child, and he feels pissed. He feels angry because he's not getting what he wants. Just imagine somebody with all of the traits that makes them antisocial, shall we say, in nature, not getting what he wants and looking at that child and thinking, what does that child represent? That child represents a future I'm not going to have because the person I'm with doesn't want to be with me. And also that person doesn't want to be with me. Now that person has the power because they're removing themselves and I don't like that. So I want to hurt that person. And all of a sudden you have this perfect moment for him where he can do both things. He can really hurt the person who's rejected him and abandoned him. And he can also destroy something that could have been positive in his future had things worked out. That kind of psychological interplay is devastating, but also clearly is a motivator in this crime. Now, down the line in the investigation, one of the things they uncover is that he'd been sending texts to his ex-girlfriend, essentially, begging her not to leave him the week before. One text from the night before actually read, "We should be capable of supporting ourselves without the expectation of depending on each other." To which Thompson replied, "Who gave you that unrealistic expectation? I'll tell you what, Thompson, anybody with any understanding about typical, well-adjusted relationships, the ideal scenario of a positive relationship is, I want you in my life. I choose to have you in my life. I do not need you. I can cope by myself. I will be okay. But you know what? Being with you, it actually makes me feel good. And it also raises me further. That's what a good relationship is. But you know what? If you leave, I'm okay. That's what we want." He doesn't see that. He sees being in a relationship more of a vampiric experience that you take from each other, you need. And it's never a good position because it creates codependency. But he's really angry about her wanting to leave him. He doesn't like that. He wants control. Now, the next day, after the police have been doing these inquiries, Thompson's brought in for further questioning at the station because the reality is they know the injuries on Jacqueline firstly don't make sense and are so severe it is absolutely brutal to understand. They need to know what the hell happened that morning. So he then tells them how after the mother of the child goes to work, he takes Jacqueline down to the lake. Of course he does. What are you going to say when you're trying to create this picture-perfect situation? "Oh, I'm such a good stepdad that after dropping one child at the bus stop to go to school, I then took Jacqueline to the lake to feed the ducks and be with nature." That's the kind of picture he's trying to create. He then said he came back. He sat her on the couch to watch TV. Anybody with a two-year-old in the history of two-year-olds know if you sit a two-year-old on the couch to watch TV, they're not on the couch for very long. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. They're places you didn't even know they could fit. That's the reality. But he then said, in that 10 minutes where he's just disappeared, using the bathroom, and I do understand some men do like to go to the bathroom. Sorry, guys, I'm going to throw this out there. You do go to the bathroom with your iPhone or whatever smart technology you've got, and you read the newspaper. You just need a little bit of space. I get it. But if you've got a two-year-old, none of you would do that because you've got a two-year-old and things can go wrong where two-year-olds are concerned. But his excuse is, "I'm in the bathroom for 10 minutes and then I hear this bang," and that's what was her collapsing. And he just tells the same story of lies that he's told them the day before. They then ask the question, "Were you ever physical with the children?" Because bear in mind, a neighbour has heard that argument about him hitting one of the kids. And he said, "If they're really out of line and not listening, I'll give them one pop," which is basically referring to spanking them. I mean, personally, I would be very clear on this. What are you doing raising a hand to somebody's child that is not yours? Stand back. That's not what you do. remove yourself from the situation. You have no right to do that. You have no right to act in that manner. But obviously he's trying to say, hey, I've got nothing to hide. Okay, I'm going to admit this. I have hit children when they have been misbehaving, but it's contextual. It was just one pop. Now, at this point, the investigators make him aware that the autopsy has been done. But at this point, they say that the official findings haven't been confirmed. But what they do know, in spite of the fact that they haven't been given the litany of injuries that are going to come out, they can tell him that they were very significant and they could not possibly have been an accident. So then he basically says that she'd recently been complaining about the fact that her back had been hurting. Just bear that in mind. And he even said that she was complaining her spine hurts. Her spine hurts. Again, I'm going to bring in my personal experience. I've got a 2-year-old child. She can point out lemons. We're good at finding the strawberry. She's pretty good at memory game. She doesn't know what her spine is. She's just figured out what her ears, nose, and eyes are. And my child is developmentally exactly where she should be. If my child came up to me at 2-year-old and was like, do you know what, Mum? My spine is hurting. I'd know she was possessed by a demon because it's not how children speak. But nonetheless, this is a story he's telling. That this child of 2 years old can be so specific and actually be diagnosing this specific issue that they're dealing with. Now, you won't be surprised to find out that when this is relayed to Jacqueline's mother says, no, that's absolutely lies. I have no memory whatsoever of Jacqueline complaining of back pain. Also, she doesn't say things like, my spine is in pain. You know, it's just not how kids speak. Now, this is a pivotal point in the investigation, of course, because they're recognising that his story is completely at odds with the mother's experience. Now, he then asks if he's free to leave. The investigators at this point agree that he can. But as he is leaving, one of the investigators confronts him again, because at this point, they've received more information from the hospital. And that information is horrifying, because it turns out Jacqueline's spine was broken. Broken. Her back was broken. Now, this is just beyond suspicious. He's just talked about the fact that she was apparently walking around complaining about spinal pain, and now we find out that her back has been broken. At this point, he goes so far as to try to blame the emergency response team. He says they could have injured her. I mean, if you're not watching paramedics routinely going to people's homes and breaking their bones, even their back, sometimes their neck, sometimes all of those things at once, what's happening with our emergency services? I mean, if they're not creating injuries so that we can then fix the injuries, they're not doing their job. It makes no sense whatsoever. Now, before he actually leaves the station, you can hear him being confronted by those investigators. And they must have been so angry because they've been sat across this murderous man who has abused this child so heinously. Her back has been broken and she has died. Now, he does walk out of that police station. And sometime after he gets home, he's sending angry texts towards the girl's mum. He's basically saying he's suicidal. It's interesting that individuals who try to threaten people emotionally with their distress doesn't then go on and actually do anything about that distress that they're claiming they feel. Because the fact that he's getting in contact with the mother who's actually lost her daughter, and I'm not saying she's perfect in this case, I am saying she's certainly grieving, she's certainly devastated by the loss of her child, that goes without saying. Now he is trying to impress on her that she needs to think about his feelings because now he's suicidal. That manipulation is basically saying, shut up, be quiet. That's the mindset of this man. Maybe he can gaslight her into silence. Now, fortunately, because he's been sending this and the mother responds and actually informs the police that he's saying these things, he's arrested under the Baker Act. Now, the Baker Act is Florida's law for providing emergency mental health services. So it allows for temporary detention. Basically means you can evaluate or you can treat a person if they have a mental illness or is considered a danger to themselves or to others. And like in the UK, when it comes down to our own Mental Health Act, it can be either voluntary or involuntary. So it involves a 72-hour hold for examination. So this is a way of protecting somebody who is saying that they are at risk to themselves or indeed at risk to others. Now, on September the 1st, 2022, this is around 4 months after Jacqueline's death, after all the testing, which was very, very attentive, that have been completed at the medical examiner's office regarding what had happened to Jacqueline, they released their official report. And it took so long because the injuries were just massive. So Jacqueline's injuries were so severe and so complex that the medical examiner had to carry out an incredibly detailed investigation. They weren't just looking for what killed her, but they wanted to know how she died, with what kind of force, and who the likely suspect was who carried out that force. So this was all done, of course, in coordination with detectives, with child protection specialists and experts, and all of those tests individually take time. And I suppose it's about gathering a case that is so airtight, they know they're going to get a guilty verdict, which is what they want. So the cause of death was determined to be so many things, really. Traumatic injuries to the victim's torso. There was a complete severing of Jacqueline's spine. She had internal bleeding behind her abdomen. So based on the severity and nature of the actual spinal break, it was determined that Thompson had applied significant gradual force to the victim's upper and lower body with a real fulcrum point on her lower back. So that was where there was intentional harm to that lower back, and that he bent her backward beyond her natural range of motion until her spine broke. Like I said, I do believe that due process should be afforded to everyone, but can we just have a button to the elevator to hell? Because this person deserves it. I suppose any kind of child abuse, as you know, triggers me. But right now, having a two-year-old little girl and thinking about somebody literally bending her backwards till she breaks, because that's what we're talking about, being broken in half, essentially. It makes me feel a rage that is pretty challenging to contain. And I just imagine what I wish could happen to these kind of killers, because they're always afforded so much more leniency, so much more care than their victims are. Now, on September the 8th, he was then brought back into the interrogation room once again because they have a lot of evidence now. And of course, he's just telling the same story. He denies all the injuries. And the detective says, what I would say, your story is bullshit. It's as simple as that. He says, that injury incapacitated that little girl. Now, following this interview and the review of the autopsy, the Marion County Sheriff's Office arrest Thompson for first-degree murder while engaged in aggravated child abuse. When deputies walk him into jail in handcuffs, one of the things he actually notices at that point are the cameras and asks, are the cameras really necessary? And I think that the police probably thought, well, we wish they weren't, because we'd like to give you a good kicking, with respect. Sorry, I know that's unprofessional, guys. But you come to me because I'm also a human. And that's what I would be thinking if I was a copper or I was a detective in this situation. Are the cameras really necessary? We wish it were not the case, kid. But again, the narcissism there, like, why does he believe that he should be treated any differently? And again, I want to bring you back to that first injury we heard about, when he was basically in trouble for breaking the arm of a four-year-old, because the belief was that that injury could have been caused in the same way that it's caused the injury to Jacqueline. Obviously, we are seeing a trajectory of an individual who has this rage within him and likes to torture kids and has just escalated that torture in this case. But we look back at who he was, 21, 22 years of age, he's doing the same with that four-year-old. Now, at this point, he was booked into the Marion County Jail. He didn't get bond, and obviously that meant he had to await his trial. Now, during the pre-trial stage, this is between 2022 to 2025, the prosecutors prepared the arguments that the injuries were inflicted by Thompson whilst he was alone with the child. Of course they were, goes without saying. And when it came down to the defence counsel, they basically say, well, we haven't really got a defence, so we'll just say he didn't cause the injuries, and it was just a fall. Now, if that fall had been from a motorway bridge or a mountain, maybe we could have got in line with the defence. But as we all know, he said, she was watching television, there was no great height, and therefore saying that she died of a fall makes no sense whatsoever. The idea that you can split somebody in half with a fall is ludicrous in such a situation. Now we get to June 2025, the jury trial is held in circuit court in Ocala, and Judge Barbara Kistner was the person presiding over it. Now the state, they have a real slam dunk case as far as I'm concerned. They've got forensics, they've got the chronology of the actual event, And the state's case focused on, of course, the medical examiner's testimony that Jacqueline's severed spine required progressive force, not an accidental bump. So it was an act of deliberately bending the child's torso beyond her natural range of motion. Sorry, I'm struggling to say these words because it just makes it go through me. Because like I said, I can't even begin to imagine the pressure, the fear, the terror, the agony that Jacqueline experienced. Also, they cite Thompson's delay in calling 911 because he knew what he'd done. So he didn't want to take responsibility for it. And also that phone call pattern, him being obviously the only person in the care of Jacqueline during the critical window where the injuries were received. And also the mother's description of finding her baby daughter lifeless with this distended abdomen on arrival. So it must have been so obvious to her that something terrible had happened. Now, when it comes down to the defence's case, they don't have one, as I said. But basically, they use Thompson's statements to detectives, which say that he and she, the victim, were in separate rooms, as if that gives any insight into reality. I mean, oh, I just said I was in a different room. OK, I'm not sure that that's a good defence. Yes, yes, we're saying he was in a separate room. He said he was in a separate room, so he couldn't have done it. Could he not just have lied about that? No. You're just assuming he lied. I'm pretty sure that it sounds like a lie, though, because everything else is consistent that he is definitely the person who's guilty. We're saying he said he was in a different room. And if that man says he was in a different room, we should believe he was in a different room. Even if he's just a murderer. Different room. We're saying he's in a different room. He's in a trailer. Just shut up. Shut up. Just different room. It's a different room. That was literally the defence. That he heard this loud noise. He found Jacqueline unresponsive and he didn't know how. Didn't know how. So the defence literally, with this case, pressed about reasonable doubt on how or when the injuries were occurred. So, jury, we're saying he was in a different room, he heard a thud, the child is in this state, he had no idea what had happened, and you should feel that as we cannot state for sure, because he wasn't on CCTV inflicting any of these injuries, that that's grounds for reasonable doubt. Sorry, jury, why are you shaking your heads? Why have you held a card saying guilty up? You're not meant to do that till later on. Just listen. We're saying it's reasonable to doubt what he said. Oh, no, no. Actually, that would mean that we were agreeing that we were doubting what he said. Ignore what I've just said. We're being reasonable about the doubt. And we're saying, is there any doubt? I've confused myself now as a defence lawyer. And even I'm not sure whether there's any doubt. And that's because, guys, there would be no doubt in anyone's mind in this situation. And also, how could there be any reasonable doubt about when the injuries occurred when we fully know that he admitted that he took the child to the lake, being dad of the year, and then got back to the trailer where she was watching TV? So we know it was within an apparent 10-minute period when only he was around. But I'm not running the defence case. I'm just saying they didn't do a very good job. In fact, on June the 5th, 2025, after just 2 hours of deliberation, just 2 hours, the jury found Travis Ray Thompson guilty of first-degree murder. Of course they did. Judge Barbara Kistner immediately, and I'm sure gleefully, sentenced him to life in prison, something that I think is too good for this kind of individual. Now, in a statement, the state attorney, Bill Gladson, said this: "This monster stole the life of an innocent child, and today the justice system made sure he will never walk free again. Life in prison is too good for this kind of evil." Amen to that, I say. Amen to that. He also said, "I'm incredibly proud of my major crimes detectives for their relentless work on this heartbreaking case. Their dedication helped secure justice for an innocent child. I also want to thank State Attorney Bill Gladson and his team for delivering a guilty verdict. In Marion County, we protect our children and we hold those who harm them accountable." Again, amen to that. Now, understandably, for Jacqueline's wider family, the loss has been horrific, and they have tried their best to keep Jacqueline's memorial arrangements private. So public reporting has basically focused on the investigation and trial rather than her funeral. But I don't even want to imagine the horror the family have felt to lose such an innocent little girl at only 2 years of age, and to lose her in such a brutal and agonizing way. Like I said, at the end of the day, hell is too good for individuals like Travis Thompson. I really mean that. I believe that there should be even a darker, fierier place for somebody who can bend and break a child and murder her in excruciating agony as she looks at a man that she thought should have been there to protect her. I know that a lot of you will have your thoughts about the mother in this case. The one thing I would know is that maybe there was a level of neglect because she had allowed this man to look after her children when he really wasn't a stable influence, although we know that monsters can mask themselves. Also, certainly, it's not necessarily that positive that children were seen wandering around by themselves and they should have been protected. But again, if she was at work believing that that was happening, we can give her that leverage in our compassion. And on top of that, the fact there was an argument where it seems like she was angry with him hitting her child, whichever one it was, that suggests again that she had boundaries within her parenting and she didn't want him breaching them. And I suppose finally she'd ended the relationship, and the worst part of it is maybe she'd never gone back to help him, she'd still have that little girl. Like I said, I'm sure she was imperfect, most human beings are, but I do want to just enable that sense of compassion and empathy to certain aspects of her parenting, even if they were not perfect. As ever, you may disagree. And I would love to know your thoughts. Please leave them in the comments. And I wish I had a big red button that just was a straight elevator where I can press it and they are just departed there immediately to burn in the fiery pits. Because my God, Travis Thompson, 100%. You take your last breath, that's exactly where you're going. See you again next time, guys. Look after yourselves. Be safe. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.